Unibet. Episode 132. Dave Barr, Ex-Trainer Spuso, Vienna Capitals.
I absolutely love my time in Vienna. All the Vienna Capital fans, you guys were the best. I truly mean it. You know, he supported us every night. It was a great experience for me. Everything was real positive. I have nothing but great things to remember about Vienna and working in Austria.
Die Tribüne erhebt sich. Und der Hexenkessel kocht. Da bleibt kein Moment, um einmal durchzuatmen. Bring it on. Mit dem Torhänder abgefälscht und die Scheibe im Tor. Aus dem Nichts. Wie schön war das gemacht?
Unibet Hockey O'Clock. The hockey season in the Ice Hockey League is now over for more than a month. Now it's getting a little calmer in the hockey realms. Only a handful of teams that are either vying for the World Championship or the Stanley Cup. So that's a perfect time to finally have him on. He has been one of the bright coaching personalities of the past 2 years. He coached Vienna to two straight semifinal appearances. He's unfortunately not going to be on Vienna's bench come next fall, but he's now here on Unibet Hockey O'Clock. It's, of course, no one else than head coach, previous head coach of the Spuse Vienna Capitals, Dave Barr. And Coach Barr, so thankful that after leaving Vienna, that you're taking the time and look back on, I guess, an interesting time in your coaching career.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to get the opportunity to coach in Vienna, coach in the Ice League. And I absolutely loved everything about it. Everything about it. All the players that, a little bit of a changeover between year one, year two with the players. But a lot of guys coming back. We had a great leadership group both years. Very fortunate to have that. It always helps the team.
Coach, I want to get to all the things that happened in the past 2 years. And obviously, I want to start with the start itself, so to speak. I remember getting the opportunity talking to you right after you came to Vienna. We talked about the team. Obviously, no one knew what eventually would hit Vienna and the league with the second of basically 2.5 pandemic years. You took over an interesting team at an interesting time with Dave Cameron getting the call from Hockey Canada and getting the opportunity to coach the Ontario Hockey League's Ottawa 67s. In came you with not a lot of time to prepare, but what you told me back during that interview kind of made me feel, okay, he's got a plan, and if that comes to fruition, Vienna is going to be a force to be reckoned with. How much was your head indeed spinning when you got to Vienna with not really enough time to get a full grasp of everything and not having had too much say in putting together the team?
It was spinning a bit for sure, but from a hockey point of view, I think I've been around for quite a while now playing and coaching that, you know, getting my plan in place, my plan's already in my head. You know, I kind of know what I want, and then you make adjustments maybe with the personnel that you have. You got a real fast team, a real big team. You know, you might make tweaks to how you want to play, but how I like to see the game played is already in me. So that wasn't, and it basically is, you know, your coach is really only as good as his players are. You know, if you have a pretty good lineup, you got a chance to be a pretty good team. If you got a really good lineup, you got a chance to be a really good team. So, we were getting players in still at that time. A few guys came in, came out. It was kind of crazy. I actually have pulled up our roster from year one, my first year there, just so I can kind of remember some of the players that we had for, you know, a week, and some of the guys that left even before we started the year. It was kind of a crazy year. And then, you know, coupled with COVID, made it interesting. Everybody, all the audience out there, had to go through it one way or another, you know, wearing masks, not going to work, whatever the case may be. So it was an interesting start. My head was spinning. I think more than anything, it was moving from North America to Vienna. And, you know, different language, although everybody, a lot of people spoke English, so that wasn't real a real problem, but just all the different things. Really enjoyed the start to my first year and the year as well.
The interesting thing is the time a person, a player, or a coach is moving overseas. A lot of them, coaching lifers, never leave North America. Some players move to Europe at an early age after probably finding out that they will never have a shot to play in the National Hockey League. You moved to Europe or coached hockey outside of North America for the first time at the tender age of 60 years old. What made you decide on that it's the right time and that Vienna is the right place to start that kind of adventure?
Near the end of my playing career, I was, played in the NHL for kind of 11 years. And my last couple, I had a couple bad injuries and I wanted to go overseas then. And I really wish I would have, looking back, 10, 20, 30 years later, well, maybe not 30 years later, but 20 years later, I was like, I wish I would have had that opportunity. But I didn't. So when it was presented to me and it was in a city that, I didn't really know, but I knew of, it became easy. And I was fortunate enough to have a wonderful assistant coach in place, Christian Dolezal. I hope he doesn't listen to this because he's going to get cocky, but he made my, made everything very easy for me. Helped out in a lot of different ways, made my personal, me living there, really fun. So that was easy as well. So it was a relatively easy decision. I hadn't been a head coach other than for U18 for Canada for quite a while, for 15 years. But as an assistant coach in the NHL for 12 years, you always kind of say, maybe I would have done that differently than what the head coach did. You support whatever his ultimate decision is, but sometimes you think a little bit differently. I'd like to do this a little bit different, do that a little bit different. So I always had my thoughts about how I would be a head coach, being that I hadn't done it for so long. But it was an easy decision and it was a great 2 years.
You kind of laying the surface for my questions, because that was one of the things that I jotted down when preparing for the interview. You not having been a head coach for an extended period of time, although the assistant coaches positions that you fill with great teams obviously got you the vast amount of experience that made you excel in the ice hockey league as well. But what was to you the biggest difference between being the guy that helps the head coach and then becoming the shot caller on the bench yourself as a head coach?
Being the guy on the bench calling the shots is,
that was too easy.
Yeah. That was quick. Can I give you a 3-second answer? Really, it all falls on you. I had coaches that helped Phil Lakos last year or last year playing for me the first year. I had veterans that, I would have meetings with all the time, my veterans, my 4, 5, 6 veteran guys, whoever that might be in the years, the leaders, the true leaders. Mario Fisher, fantastic. Mario was just an absolute rock. He had his thoughts and most of them were always aligned with mine. But he also had some thoughts that weren't. And, I heard about it and ultimately I had to make the decision off that. So there's a bunch of things. I think the biggest thing would be that ultimately the final decision the hockey decision would be mine. But I listened to and had a lot of good input before it got to that point. You know, sometimes it'd be you have 5 seconds to think about it. You're on the bench. Do you pull the goalie now? What do you do here? But you're not always going to make every correct decision on those real quick ones. But, you know, you just kind of take the odds. I'm a big odds guy. I like gambling. And if the odds are in your favor, then you try to go ahead and do it. If they're not, then, you know, maybe you shouldn't do it. So it's ultimately that final decision.
You get to Vienna fairly late because of the unexpected coaching opportunity that presented itself to Dave Cameron. The team had already been put together in large parts without you. So a new city, a new environment, a new team. What were kind of your first couple of steps in trying to take control?
The level of play, I didn't really know where the level of play was. I got here, I think, it was August 7th or 8th. That's right. It was a little bit late, about a week into camp. And I think Christian Dolezal was running practices. So I got here about a week late just because of the circumstances. And I didn't really know the level of play. I didn't really know any of the players. The Austrian players, I didn't know at all. I knew of a few of the North American players or the imports. So that was one thing to see, like, who am I coaching here? What level of play, how good are they individually? How good is a group? What can I expect? The ice size being bigger. I didn't find that to be hardly any different, which I'm really surprised about. Really didn't change the play much. Probably the biggest thing was getting to know the players individually and then collectively as a group, just, what can I expect? How hockey knowledgeable are these guys as a group and individually as well? Again,
the interesting thing in getting to know those kind of players, and I talk to a lot of coaches, and almost all of them have some kind of leadership council in one way or the other. When you first met the team, when you assessed the players, their character, and how they mix and mesh. How did you try to come up with your way of a leadership council?
I relied on, again, Christian Dolezal for his input. And then truly what you want to do is you want to put the 5 or 6 guys in that leadership group who have respect of the players that, aren't in that group. You can't be get a young 21-year-old superstar to be in your leadership group if he doesn't have the respect of the other 20 or so guys in the dress room. So you can't, it has to be real. It can't be made up. I don't remember making any changes, when you maybe have an import come in that nobody really knows all that well. It looks like he's going to be a good leader for you, and he's just not. Not everybody's a leader. Not everybody's, that person that can handle the responsibility of being the guy that's a go-to guy. They can be 34 years old, play 14 years professionally, and still not be that guy. So I don't remember, leaving anybody out or changing any of our leadership groups. But at the same time, that's one of the most important things to a head coach are his leaders and the leadership group, the group that he had. And I was blessed. Vienna was blessed with the guys that we had. I mentioned Mario Fischer, Starkey, Bernard Starkbaum. And if I ever can't remember anybody's first name, it's because I'm always calling them by their nicknames. And I don't even know if I know half the young Austrians, especially their first name. I just know their nickname. That's it. So I'm just giving nicknames out there. But, some of the leaders that we had they were fantastic for the 2 years that I was there for.
The one interesting thing about Vienna that they're always kind of famously self-proclaiming is that they want to see young Viennese players from their own junior program implemented, maybe one or two being implemented each and every year. Is that, and that's the perspective, like from the outside looking in, and what you hear and read in the newspapers, is that, or was that part of the sales pitch, the importance of having Viennese players on the Vienna squad, and you as someone who's been coaching juniors very successfully, that you had to quote unquote try to implement them?
I think it's I'm a big football fan, soccer fan, you know, and that's what the vast majority of pretty much every big team in the in Europe has a feeder system. You know, the U23s, the U21s, and it's the same thing in Vienna. And I believe it's so important for those 14, 15, 16-year-olds to be, you know, to look up at our team, our players, and go, I want to be that guy. That's the guy that I really like watching play, you know, whoever that might be, whether it's an import or an Austrian, doesn't matter really. So I think it's extremely important, and I'm going to use the story here that happened this year, and I'm going to have to use his name because otherwise it has no credibility to it. Matthias Boom. He played for us a little bit in the first year. And I'm ultimately going to give him a real pat on the back, but initially it's going to be a little hard. Is I didn't really love his attitude and his way about getting things done, how it was. And he's a young man. He was 17 or 18 the first year. That's young. And he wasn't doing what I thought. And the body language, the work ethic, the determination, the willingness to get dirty. And he was just a young man. So when we started my year two, you know, he's a big guy. We needed size on our team. You need young size. You can't have a bunch of, and I'll use North American sizing here, but a bunch of 5'7" guys. You need some 6'2", 6'3" guys, some big, strong guys who can win battles a little bit easier. And I didn't want him on the team. I didn't want attitude. What I want from players is I want a good attitude, a good team attitude, do what it takes to win, try to improve every day, that type of thought process. And I didn't think he had it. So we didn't even bring him to camp. We got put in a position about 15 games into the year, I'm guessing a little bit, about 15 games into the year where we had six forwards out of the lineup and we had nobody. We had to call him up. So I called him into my office and I told him exactly what I'm telling you. I said, Boomer, his nickname's Boomer. I go, Boomer. I said, I didn't even want you here this year. What do you think of that? And he goes, well, you know, he kind of replied. And I said, prove it to me. And I told him what I needed him to do. All the stuff I said earlier, working hard, being the last guy on the ice, being the first guy on the ice, all that extra stuff, improving, truly trying to improve your game. Just because you're big and you have skill doesn't mean you're going to play in the Austrian League or in the DEL or in the Swiss League or for your national team. Doesn't mean you have to improve. You have, and so challenged them real hard. And I tell you what, I give Boomer all the credit in the world because I wasn't really hard on him after that, but I was on him, you know, daily about don't let up. You were good yesterday. Don't take a step back. You know, I was like this on him all the time. And I think he became very proud of what he was doing daily and the difference he was making in himself. And he came to me one game. I think he played three or four shifts in a game. And I said, you know who put you out? You know why you only played 2.5 minutes last game? And he goes, well, that's because you only put me on the ice three or four times. And I said, no. I said, you only put yourself on the ice three or four times. I was just the one that was watching you. I said, I would have put you on the ice 14 times. If you would have given more of what we're asking you to do. So that was a little bit of a lesson for him. So the importance of our young guys coming through the system with the right attitude, with the right skill set, is very, very important to every team, but especially Vienna, especially with the number of players that are playing here. So it's very, very important to the team.
I received a lot of questions that were posted on an online forum that I should hand to you and ask you in lieu of some of the fans' interests, and one of them kind of tackles that topic as well, because one fan wanted to know and maybe there is a moral to the story you just told. What has to be done for Vienna to implement even more players from its own junior program? Not that it's going to be a cautionary tale for your successor Mark Hapscheid, that he has to call each and every maybe underperforming junior player into his office and really get a hard look at them. But what's the way of having even more Viennese players adding to an already strong Viennese core?
It's a great question. It's not a super easy one to answer, but
we've got time.
Okay.
Hopefully you do as well.
Okay. Well, here's my answer. Working in the NHL, playing in the NHL and working in the NHL, you come to realize, especially when you're working there and you see a guy for the first time, you see you see a second round draft pick come to training camp for the first time. You know, he's got good size. He can skate. Not everybody is going to play in the NHL. It's pretty obvious. There's only whatever it is, 650 jobs. That's it. And obviously that changes almost daily, but not everybody can play in the Austrian League. So the better job that they do with 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds and 12-year-olds and 14-year-olds in developing their skills, developing their work ethic, their hockey smarts. We want to play. Like, you don't think I want a good young player to break into the lineup, especially this year when we had three or four long-term injuries, like basically the whole season with two or three guys, and then we had three or four other injuries. We were down 5-6 forwards the whole year. And I want a young 20-year-old to be able to play in this league. That doesn't mean he can. If I only play him three shifts, it's probably because I'm holding my breath every time I put him out there. No knock against any of the guys that played for us this year. They tried their best for the most part, but you have to get to that level, and I know they're working very, very hard, and they have some very capable coaches coaching these younger players. They're very good. I watch their practices and go, hey, that's a good drill. I'm going to use that one. There's so many things so many good things that they're doing. So it's a matter of just keep working at it, and the development is huge. Like, what makes a guy have hockey smarts? Can you teach hockey smarts? I'm still looking for that. I don't know if you can. I don't know if there's things that you can do in practice that will make a player kind of more savvy, smarter, because there's guys like Matt Bradley, very smart hockey player. I didn't need to coach him very much. I didn't need to. He kind of knew what to do. I just say, hey, Brad's, and he go, I know, stupid, that type of thing. And I go, thank you. And then I'd move on. I don't have to coach. And it's not like he's 33. He was 25, I think, when he came here. He was 4 or 5 years in the East Coast Hockey League. He's a smart hockey player. So how do you get how do you coach hockey smarts? I mean, that's the biggest thing. If you can figure out how to coach hockey smarts, get a guy's 10% smarter. So, I mean, that's the challenge of the youth coaches everywhere out there, and especially, the Vienna Capitals want young players coming through their system. They want three or four or five guys, three or four guys a year challenging for positions every year.
I want to remain with implementing new players and players from the system with one last question, and then we're gonna talk a little bit about off the ice stuff. But the first year when you got to Vienna, you had a farm team in the Alps Hockey League at your hands, a joint program between Vienna and the Mosel Medical Graz 99ers. That wasn't the case last year. How did that change how you dealt with the team? Did it change anything at all?
It didn't change a ton. We still called up guys as we needed to. I'm just looking on my thing here just to see. Timo Pellier. I don't know if I pronounced his last name right or not, but
almost very close.
He was in Zelemse. And so we called him up two or three times where he would take the train into Vienna or he would meet us on the road. So when we needed a player kind of, you know, today, you know, this morning somebody's sick, somebody's, you know, can't play, then we need to get somebody in because we only have five or four defensemen, depending in this case with Timo. So we would get him in. So I didn't really notice it that much. We called up a couple other young players I can't remember their names now. Sorry, I apologize. I should, but I've never been great with names. But, you know, they played four, five, six games for us because we had nine forwards and we had to call somebody up, even if they weren't quite ready to play, which these guys were right on the edge. They did a good job coming in. I'm going to look up their name because I feel bad because I can't remember them. So it's really very nice to have a farm team in town, but I don't think it's the end of the world if you don't.
You can take your time looking up the names. As stated, we've got time. I'll just jump to my next question and we can jump
Nils
back.
Nils Granitz and Daniel Aschauer. Thank you.
There you go. There you go. Glad that you took your time. As stated, we've got more than enough of it. But going to Vienna and coming to a new country, and you already alluded a little bit to some of the challenges, even though Vienna, world-renowned city, a lot of people speaking English anyways, and we'll switch languages if needed. But talking to new to Austria players or coaches, one of the things that always kind of causes a kind of cultural shock is stick shift in cars. But what was the moment in Vienna or in Austria where you thought, okay, this is different than I expected. This is something I've never seen. Was there ever that moment of being culturally challenged, so to speak?
I'm smiling as you got to the, I don't know if I really should say this or not, but I will. I'm usually pretty up front. Is I'm a pretty social person. And I lived about a 5-minute walk away from the rink, and I obviously every morning get up, walk to the rink, and I was kind of surprised because there wasn't a lot of eye contact with other people, and it threw me for a loop. For, you know, typically just to have that eye contact, maybe a little head nod, especially when nobody else is around. You know, it's one thing if you're 700 people and you're crowded, you know, you're not looking for eye contact. But I used to say that to my assistant coach all the time. I said, like, he would say to me, "You get any eye contact today, Dave?" And I said, "Nope, not even close." So that was just, I don't know if one other import or one other person from out of town would notice that, but I noticed it. It kind of stuck with me. I love the fact really got to, like, I had a car available to me. I bet you I drove the car 25 times in 2 years. And just because of the public transportation was fantastic in Vienna. It was great. So that was good. People riding bikes, I think, is fantastic. other than you got to make sure you're not walking in the bike lanes. You got to be careful of that. I almost got dinged a few times falling asleep in the walk in the bike lane. But really, there wasn't a huge difference. A little bit food, but the bread is fantastic. The coffee's great. But it wasn't a huge transition, if you want to call it that. Once I got used to the way that, you know, food was presented, packaged for you at grocery stores. Oh, here's one. I wasn't used to grocery stores essentially being closed on Sunday. So my assistant coach, Dolly, would say to me, he goes, okay, there's a holiday on Monday, and this would be Friday or Saturday. And basically saying, if you need to get groceries, you better get it today because you're going to have 2 days of not being able to get it. And I was shopping kind of a daily type thing. I'd shop daily. So that was kind of a little bit used to getting used to the fact of grocery stores being closed on Sundays.
Just to get back on the first thing that you mentioned, not getting eye contact from other people in Vienna, it's perfectly normal. I lived in Vienna for 5 years as well. I'm from a rural area in Austria where everybody greets you on the streets. But in Vienna, it's basically, especially on public transportation, it's basically everybody minding his or her own business. It seems as if it's trying not to make eye contact. So it's probably a very Viennese or maybe a big city thing. But if you wanted to get a lot of people seeking eye contact or greeting you, you should have gone for a hike in Vienna's surroundings. It's like 10 kilometers outside of the city. It's a totally different world. But it's always great to get someone sharing kind of his side of the stories and putting his perspective on how people in Vienna and at times in Austria really are. So great on that, but let me take you back kind of ringside and take you back to Tuesday, March 22nd of 2022. Does that date ring a bell?
It would mean that I think we're in the playoffs my first year. Is that game 7? Yeah, that was an experience with, I wasn't on the bench because of COVID. And, you know, my assistant coach wasn't, or maybe he was on the bench. I can't remember, but I know I wasn't. And we had, it was an incredible, incredible job done by Philip. And then the players, just, we had a lot of guys out of the lineup against Klagenfurt. And it was one of the most exciting games I haven't, you know, been involved in prep for the game, but that was it. And it wasn't on the bench, and it was just one of the best experiences I've been through in hockey. Just the fans after the game, during the game, just all the moments during the game. I have goosebumps right now just thinking about what a wonderful, great game that was. I was so happy for our players, but I think I was even happier for our fans just because, you know, probably Vienna's biggest rival. And we beat them in game 7 when we're missing a heck of a lot of guys because of COVID and other reasons.
You were indeed spot on. It was game 7 that happened or took place on March 22nd of last year. The head coach in that game, on the official game sheet, not only on the official game sheet, but on the bench as well, Philipp Ulrich. You guys played a great series that went back and forth. Obviously, after game 6, we knew game 7 would be happening, but we also knew that Vienna already playing shorthanded would potentially play even more shorthanded. You were out. So many difference makers were out. You had a short lineup. You had to bring up basically the entire Alps Hockey League team and every viable player who was able to skate and hold a stick in the Vienna area code. How were the days, the hours leading up to the all decisive game 7 with those circumstances that I just mentioned?
We got good goaltending is one thing. I think Starkey was our goalie for that one.
Played out of his mind.
Yeah, he played very well. You know, he made those saves that, you know, just, boy, that was a big save. You know, boy, that was big. And then it almost seemed like it was going to be an automatic, that we didn't have to worry about goaltending. We were going to get good goaltending. And that probably did it, I think, in regards to our younger players who were playing way more than they normally would. And then some of our veterans that, you know, you're leaning on to play maybe an extra 3 or 4 or 5 minutes in the game 7. And they got to the where you, when you know they're going to have to score a real nice goal to beat your goalie, you play with more confidence. You know, you make a little bit of mistake, nobody panics. You just get back and you defend however you have to. And we scored enough to win. And it was this is one of those things where everybody kind of rose to the occasion. Nobody played beyond what they could play. Everybody just kind of maximized, and we played as a team. And I think the biggest thing is you know, there weren't ups and downs. And I give Philip a lot of credit for this on the bench, kind of keeping things even keeled. You know, where we had a good shift, we had a bad shift. We don't change. We just go out and try to play our best shift the next shift. And it was so incredible as the game was going along. It was like, oh my God, we have a chance to win this thing. You know, you're getting into the third period and you feel good about Starkey being in net. And, you know, you feel good that you can win this thing. And then when it ultimately happened, I remember the last few seconds and in the next round, we lost to Salzburg in that game 2 or 3 where we're ahead by 2 goals with 1:10 left. And they scored, you know, off a face-off, and then another one with like 10 seconds left and to tie it. And then we lose in overtime. So as you're going along, you're going, we got a chance to win. We got a chance to win. And obviously we did win. It was truly special game. I'll remember that one forever.
Where did you follow that game, and how does one have to envision and Dave Barr, who's been stricken with COVID, how does one have to envision him following the game in his apartment?
I was watching it by myself with a little bit of contact in between periods. I'd call after during the intermission, talk to Christian Dolezal about, you know, certain things. Sometimes I might want to talk to Philip, but they were doing, those guys are experienced. Philip's an experienced hockey guy, and they were doing a lot of what I would do. So I didn't want to, I wanted him to kind of coach the way that he would coach, that he can't pretend he's me. So they didn't need expertise thrown at them from me. So it was weird. It was surreal. I'm calling family in between, telling them what's going on. I can't, so it was kind of a weird feeling watching your team, go through a wonderful experience. I wish it was on the bench, but I'd rather him be on the bench than me off it than me on it and lose. So it was a great experience. And I was really proud for the players because of winning in front of their fans, their family. It was an awesome thing.
Even for us broadcasters, I vividly remember my pundit Greg Holes being close to tears after what he had seen on that day. And it has to be, and it will always remain, one of the more memorable Game 7s that we had in the Ice League. Eventually, it's Salzburg sweeping the Caps, Salzburg winning the title, you heading into your first and obviously last offseason as a Vienna Capitals head coach. The previous year, you arrived with the team already being in place. The next year, you had an opportunity to put more of your fingerprints in, obviously cooperation with the management on the team. How did you try to do that during last summer?
The way I feel about, building a team is I want good people first. My 2 years, it's so easy to say this. We had good people in our dressing room. It was the players' dressing room, the leadership group running the dressing room. We had good leaders. They were good people. Like, you'd be proud if they were your sons. And that was number one for me, is I would rather bring in a lesser hockey player that was a good person, got along with people, had a good work ethic, et cetera, than a guy who was maybe a little bit more skilled, but not really a guy that, you know, not a real team guy, you know. So that was a big part of it. I'll go back. We lost, in my first year, we lost three kind of prominent players in August. Sean Lalonde left, Cliff Pooh left, and my God, who's the other one? One other guy, French-Canadian guy, I'll think of his name. He left as well. He retired. So that was a big change. That's two high-end forwards for us. One, you know, one number one D for us that left. So we had to kind of fill those spots. So we were lucky enough. We got a little bit lucky, quite a bit lucky with Matt Bradley coming in. And we had, I think, Joel Lowry at the same time came in. And those were two, like, Joel's a pain in the ass to play against. He's a big guy, smart hockey player, edgy all the time. And Matt Bradley was Swiss Army knife. He did everything for us. He could play on the power play, penalty kill, play physical. He could defend. He would win faceoffs. We were very lucky to have them in Shepherd for the year. So ultimately, the second year, you're trying to get good people. You know, I would end up talking. We'd watch Dolly and I would watch them on video. And then we go, okay, this guy looks like he can add this to our team, you know, size, speed, whatever it might be. And then being that I've been around the hockey world for a while, typically I could find out about his character with a phone call. So you find out what the guy's really like, what's he like on a, you know, what's he going to be like over here? Is he going to work at practice? Does he do this? Does he do that? So you find out about their character and you know, that's what we tried to bring in. And for the most part, we got that, you know, pretty close to bang on. And then you're hoping as a group that you can be good enough to win with that.
The one thing that stands out, especially when looking at the past few years, that Vienna was great in bringing in talent fairly late. Matt Bradley, late addition after the start of the year. Luke Moncada, who was a key cog, not only in that Game 7, but also last year for Asiaga, showed that he belonged, showed that he can play. Late addition. This year, Ben Finkelstein, late addition, tearing down the league with his play, becoming a point-per-game scorer as a defenseman. Why is good management? Why have you got a knack for bringing in high-profile talent that flew under the radar for a lot of other organizations?
Okay, I'll speak about Ben Finkelstein for one thing. Ben is as the fans in Vienna found out, he is elite at creating offense, being involved in offense, making, you know, giving the puck to a player when he wants it, being able to make those passes. Our guys found out very quickly that if they got open and Ben had the puck on his stick, there's a real good chance he's going to get that puck to you. Some people just don't have the vision to be able to see that guy on the back door there. Ben did. So he made a big difference. The reason why Ben Finkelstein came to Vienna is there's a few reasons. And the main reason was he turned down quite a bit more money in a few other spots. He came because of Vienna, the Capitals, the coaches, and mainly because he knew who his teammates were going to be. He knew Zimmer very well. He knew Bradley very well. They told him, it's a great spot. We have a great thing going here. You're going to love it, and you'll play, and we have a chance to win. A big thing, a big part of that, nobody wants to come to a team that loses. We have a chance to win if you come here. And so that's why he came. It wasn't because of money. We outpaid, out, out, he turned down more money on other teams to come here because he wanted to win. And he liked the makeup of the team and the way the team was run here.
Speaking of Ben Finkelstein, I was never sure if it's Finkelstein or Finkelstein, as it would probably be pronounced in German, but you already hopefully gave away the correct pronunciation. As he tore down the league, as I already alluded to, everybody was looking forward to seeing him, seeing you go on a prolonged playoff run, but he got injured, and the entire playoffs, and Vienna's usually very secretive about who's available on game day and about injuries and if it's a long-term injury or not. But each and every game that we as a crew covered with the Vienna Capitals involved, we heard, well, could be ready. Maybe this is a game where Ben Finkelstein gets back on the ice. Was it ever close for him to be getting back, or was it indeed a long-term injury that just never got out?
I'll go back to his name. I don't know if it's Finkelstein or Finkelstein, so we'll let the Viennese people or the Austrian people figure out what it is. I don't know what it is. He really, you know, as we moved along through the playoffs, I wasn't sure if he was going to be able to play. He had a broken foot. And it's one of those things that it's not displaced. It's a crack, you know, whatever it is, a little something there. And I'll tell you what, that is one tough kid. He wanted to play, and he wanted to play with 2-3 games. And ultimately, what were going to be the last 2 or 3 games, he wanted to play in all those 3 games. He couldn't. There's no way. We watched him skate in morning skate, and he can't skate. And, you know, if he's going to play 28 minutes for us in a game or 18 minutes for us in a game, maybe in this case here, we were, you know, thinking of just playing him on the power play because he's such a good power play guy, and just stay away from the action.
He was close to playing, but he really wasn't.
Very unfortunate, but lucky enough, fans of the German Hockey League, the DEL, will be able to see him next year, as he'll potentially score a lot of goals and points for the Eisbären Berlin. One of the interesting things already during your first year was seeing one of your players back in the day at Guelph Storm with Rafael Rotte again coaching against him, and then 1 year later him rejoining the Vienna Capitals and you being able to coach Rafael Rotte again almost 20 years later after you first kind of encountered him. How was it coaching against him, and how was it to coach him again?
Yeah, I got to go back to Ben Finkelstein here. I think it was his wrist. I'm really bad with stuff like that. I think it might have been his wrist. But I apologize. It was the same injury, whether it was his wrist or his foot. We had so many guys injured this year that I kind of confused it. So either way, he was close to playing, but he couldn't play. Coaching Rafi. If somebody asked me, I coached 4 years in Guelph. If somebody asked me, who is your favorite? Give me your favorite 3 or 4 players. Rafi would have been one for sure. He played 3 years for me. He's a warrior. There's a few things that he's very stubborn at. Stick length. Rafi might be laughing if he ever listens to this podcast. But you know, I wish he would have had a longer stick. He thought a shorter stick was going to help him. But that's Rafi right there. He is very, very determined to play the way that he thinks he can make a difference in a game, which for the most part is very good. He was super competitive. I think his second year, we had a really good team in Guelph. Ryan Callahan, Matt D'Agostini, they both ended up playing in the NHL. We had some good defensemen played in the NHL. And, you know, we didn't get it done, but he's one of my favorite players. And I think that the reason for it is his competitiveness. He would not back down from anybody. And, you know, he played 15 or 16 years in Austria, mainly for Vienna, with that exact same, you know, the exact same way. He was just, he's a very, very competitive guy. He prepares himself to be the best teammate. He's one of the best teammates going. Teammates love him. He's very, very supportive, very inclusive, includes everybody, makes sure the young guys are taken care of. He's just a great guy to have around.
Truer words have seldomly been spoken on this podcast. Indeed, one of the very bright spots in terms of Austrian hockey, and hopefully we'll see him for another year in Vienna or someplace else, I think. Contract extension hasn't been officially announced yet. Hopefully it's coming. A couple of fan questions that I still want to ask you, and then I want to round this out with a little chat about the National Hockey League. We already talked about probably the highlights of your time in Vienna with the Game 7 victory against Klagenfurt, but one fan wanted to know what the highlights of your tenure in Vienna were. So plural.
I think the my highlights, Dave Barr's highlights, you know, obviously the head coach the last couple of years in Vienna, is the relationships I had with the players here. It was kind of funny because just speaking of Matt Bradley, first year, second year, Dave Barr was a little bit different in the second year. I was hard. Not that I wasn't demanding in the first year, but I was hard and I was probably too hard at moments. And so I think the players are a little bit surprised with seeing me the way I was a few times. And that it was me just trying to get the best out of them, demanding more. And I think that the highlight for me, I'm kind of going a roundabout way of getting to this, is my relationship with the players. The common goal of both of the players and myself of wanting to win for Vienna, wanting to win for the Capitals. And the thing that I take out of it is the personal relationships between the players and then, you know, my coaches as well. And also with Franz. Franz was very, very supportive of my coaching the whole time. We worked together to make everything work. I went back three times to North America during the season this year, just for family reasons. No real problems, but just because it was hard on my family to not have me around. So I went back three times. Franz allowed that. And I really, it was very, very good for him. So it was the relationships is what made my time here special with the players, the coaches, and to some degree, the fans. You don't get that personal interaction with the fans, but I just grew to absolutely love and expect to hear that one end, especially going crazy. And then the rest of the fans just jumping on board when we were playing well and playing an exciting brand of hockey.
You leave in the league with 118 games coached, 58 of them victorious, puts you at a win rate of 49.2%, a tad short of 50%, but knowing the circumstances, the COVID kind of crisis, all the injuries that they piled up, especially this past year, you still being able to get to two straight semifinal appearances, very impressive, but of course, a lot of fans are wondering, at what time was the decision made that you wouldn't return, that you'd go back to North America to be closer to your family?
It was formally made in, I think it was middle of February, somewhere in there, where I talked to Franz and let him know that I would not be returning. It didn't affect one bit the way I coached, way I thought, effort that I put in did not affect me one bit. It's not who I am. It's not the way. So it, the only thing it affected is I wanted I wanted the Vienna Capitals to have as much time as possible to look for a coach. That's the reason why I did it. It wasn't for me. I could have let them know at the end of the year, end of the playoff season. I could have let them know then, but I wanted them to be able to, you know, move forward as they're thinking about players and you know, how they can fill the vacancy. I wanted to give them as much time as possible. So that's how that happened.
And of course, it's Mark Hapscheid being your successor, someone you played with back in the day in the National Hockey League. To someone who hasn't followed what Hapscheid's done in Fakir with the Beamer Pioneers, coming from you as a fellow coach, what kind of coach will Vienna be getting with Mark Hapscheid?
I know when we played them this year and he was coaching, that we were up against a team that was organized, you know, had a way of playing. So beyond that, I can't comment too much on Mark. I had him for a teammate for 1 year. I think we were line mates a few times. We played on the same line in Detroit. I know he's had success wherever he's been. So I'm expecting you're getting a good coach who's organized. And then so much of, what happens this year with personnel is huge. Mario Fischer coming back would be great for the team. I don't know where they're at. Maybe he's already coming back. I don't know. But, having that leadership group, whatever it might be, it looks like there's going to be a heck of a lot of changes this year with Vienna, just from what I'm understanding. I haven't followed it very closely, but it looks like there's going to be some changes or quite a few changes. So, having that core of players will dictate a little bit maybe how he coaches. I can't really comment too much on Mark. I know he was a real happy-go-lucky guy when he was a teammate of mine. And I kind of, touch base with him every once in a while. Once every 5 years, we talk. But other than that, I'm guessing you're getting a very good coach, a very experienced coach who has his definite thoughts about how he'd like to see the game played.
Second to last question. What's next for you?
I'm still, North America runs later than Europe. I'm looking for the best coaching position I can get that makes sense to me. And then location, it's in North America. I'm based in Nashville right now. My wife is here. I have a daughter who lives just outside Toronto, have a son who lives in Minneapolis area. So I'd like to be in a position that I would be fairly easy to see them. So it's not always that easy to get a job that's close by. But I'm talking to a few teams right now, different levels. It looks like there should be a good opportunity, but you never know. You never know. Never know how it's going to play out. I think my time in Europe has really served me well. My time in Vienna has really served me well in regards to showing that you can coach and handle a team. We had very good special teams both years of me working in Vienna. We had a real top PK, top PP. Dolly did a great job on the PK. But that's just a way of showing that you can, organize a group and get a group to play as one. So I think I'll have a good opportunity, but we'll see. So I'm looking kind of everywhere that has interest. Any jobs that open up, there's probably, 20 jobs available right now. And I'm, poking my nose in wherever it might be the right fit for me.
Of course, there will be a couple of thumbs pulled for you overseas in Austria for you to be getting that opportunity that you desired, the right kind of opportunity. There's still an opportunity for three teams in the National Hockey League playing for or winning the Stanley Cup. As of this recording, the series between the Vegas Golden Knights and the Dallas Stars is still ongoing. Florida has already got their ticket for the Stanley Cup finals. You haven't coached there for a year, and obviously that just shows how a big a turnover from year to year and even half a decade later is. I think only Sasha Barkov remaining on that Florida team or still remaining on the Florida team that you coached back in the days. There's still a soft spot for the Panthers in your heart, and if so, are they the team that has it to win the Stanley Cup, or would you place your bet on another team?
Wow. I got ties to everything. Dallas Stars head coach Pete DeBoer is a guy that I worked with for 7 years. So I have a real soft spot for him and Steve Spott with Dallas. And I played in Dallas as well. Dallas's first year in the NHL was the year I played for Dallas. So I have a bit of a soft spot for Dallas, but I'm kind of cheering for, I would cheer for Dallas would be my first pick. But I love what's happened in Florida. I really enjoyed my 1 year in Florida. It was kind of a tough year. They fired Gerard Gallant about halfway through the season, and I was his associate head coach. We had played together. We were good friends. He brought me in there to help out. Didn't work. But I'm really happy with Paul Maurice and the team there. Aaron Ekblad is another player that was in Florida when I was there. Bobrovsky's playing. He's playing a little bit like Starkey did for us in game 7. he's a wall back there. And so it's a lot of fun seeing the energy, how much fun they're having. And you don't have fun by playing crappy. You have fun by doing things right. And they are doing a lot of things right. They're playing an aggressive game. They're playing a physical game. Everybody's buying in. And so it's a lot of fun watching Florida. And Vegas is another group. I coached Eichel in Buffalo. I coached Peter Angelo way back, U18. I coached U18 twice. Way back, I coached Peter Angelo as well. So I know a few of the players all over. But it's really fun watching. You can see the ups and downs. Now that Dallas won last night in overtime, they're down 3-1. They're going back to Vegas. It'll be really interesting to see how that plays out. First 5 or 10 minutes, is Vegas tightening up? Are they going to play loose and play hard like they've been doing, good defensively? And then also, is Dallas going to get goaltending? Goaltending, they have one of the better goalies in the league who's been a little bit off and on. And are they going to get goaltending? So I really enjoy following the playoffs every night here. I kind of missed it when I was in Vienna, because it would be on at 3 a.m. or whatever time it was on at, and I'd just catch the highlights the next day. But I had enough work to do of my own anyways. But it has been a really fun playoff season. I look forward to continuing watching it.
Great stuff. I want to finish this with something that reached me from a Vienna fan. He just sent me a text, or he just wrote, "Please tell Dave Barr that he's a great guy. Period. Mission accomplished." So there you go. Coach, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you so much for taking more than an hour of your valued time. Wishing you all the best for your future endeavors. And as the hockey world's a really small one, we'll probably run into each other somewhere down the road. Thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure. I just want to say to all the hockey fans out there in Austria, I absolutely love my time in Vienna. All the Vienna Capital fans, you guys were the best. I truly mean it. You supported us every night. It was a great experience for me. And everything was real positive. I have nothing but great things to remember about Vienna. And working in Austria, and all the fan support in the Ice League. And it was a true pleasure. And I look forward to maybe seeing you again sometime.
Exzellente Unterhaltung mit dem schönsten Sport der Welt.
Unibet Hockey.